war and peace, she will be invaluable in convincing the Dream Master of the wisdom of our case.
In the crowd, a pair of demons stand with the body of a human woman bound at their feet. The female demon is the Merkin. She has a head like an upturned dog's skull. It has teeth at its crown, red skin stretched over it, and three eyes set off-center, like glass buttons. The Merkin isn't naked. Her incongruously female body is draped in an expensive evening dress with shoulder-length gloves.
And Corinzon, once a creature of Beelzebub's and most foully betrayed by that shifty dupe of Lucifer, now one of us.
Next to the Merkin stands an old adversary of the Lord of Dreams. Corinzon, the demon, with wide eyes and two mouths full of sharp pointed teeth, one beneath the other, stands preening, dressed in a ripped t-shirt, stockings and garter belt. Both mouths are grinning. Since he lost his duel with Morpheus in Hell, Corinzon has a new set of scars over his body and one side of his face, a legacy of his time with agony and ecstasy.
Yes, until the end of time, Princess Azel!
In an instant, they are alone. Just Azazel, the Merkin, and Corinzon, and the bound human woman who lies at their feet.
The dream creature will of course accede to our wishes. He must see that Hell is ours by right. He must return our lands to us. But if he fails to see reason, we have something to help him make up his mind. He is a reasonable being, after all, and he will be willing to trade.
Azazel looks down at their captive, her hands and feet bound with what looks like barbed wire, staring around wildly. She was the queen of an African civilization 10,000 years gone, who Morpheus loved and lost.
Isn't that right, little Miss Nada?
Kaiku.
The Dreaming. Today, Morpheus's castle is perched high up on a twisted skein of volcanic rock. Flying away from it is a tiny black dot. It is Matthew the Raven flying down over the forest towards a cave entrance, halfway up a mountainside.
Eve! You there?
Eve, widow of Adam, and the mother of Cain and Abel, emerges from the cave she lives in. She has grown old and overweight. Her hair is grey and scraggy, and she wears a shapeless dress.
Matthew, welcome back. What news?
Of the boss? Nothing really. He's still hiding out in his suite in the castle. He won't talk to anyone. Not even me.
He's like a little child.
Eve reaches down her hand to Matthew, who hops up onto it. She now looks middle-aged. Her grey hair is streaked with black. Her face is less lined.
Oh, and he's moved the castle to the top of a mountain.
He's expecting unwelcome visitors, then. He only does that when he's feeling antisocial.
Eve brings Matthew up to look at him, her hands encircling his folded wings and body. She now looks even younger. Her hair is all dark.
I'm sure this will sort itself out. These things usually do.
I hope so. I've never seen him this out of it before.
No. But you have not been with us long, little Raven. He gets black moods on him sometimes. Worse than this one sounds. Much worse.
Is there anything we can do?
Of course, my darling. We can wait.
It is twilight in Dream's private quarters. All the windows show is a dark grayness. No lamps are lit. Morpheus sits against a wall, his knees drawn up to his chin. He looks like someone who hasn't slept for weeks. Nearby is the white marble statue of the Griffin. It speaks.
My lord.
Oh, go away.
We have visitors at the gate. My lord, there are many of them.
Tell them to go away. I am not receiving visitors at this time.
But they are envoys, my lord. I recognize a few of them. Some have been here before, as honored guests. Some of them are gods. All of them are puissant.
Gods.
We gatekeepers cannot keep them all out should they take it to force their way in. Not unless you lend us power, Lord. Not unless you lend us strength.
Enough.
What shall we do, Lord?
Let them in.
If you do not open this fat-sucking door, then Mahama Mjolnir will smash it to toothpicks!
Thor's eyes bulge. A vein in his forehead throbs.
Who? I am the mighty Thor!
He stands at the head of a disparate group of people at the main gate of Dream's castle. It is a wooden door, some 20 feet high, set into a rock wall with its three guardians, the real griffin to the left of the gate, the dragon-like wyvern curled around its upper lintel, and the hippogriff, a winged horse, on the right. They look down upon the assembled throng. Even the tallest of them, and most of them are tall, are dwarfed by the door and its guardians. Many are clustered together, each in their own group. Here, Azazel, the Merkin, Coranzon. There, we see Loki, Odin, and Thor, brandishing his hammer. The two angels, Remiel and Duma, hang in the air above, gazing down soberly at the scene. To one side, the three Egyptian gods, Anubis, Bes, and Bast, stand in a little cluster. A tall bronzed man with a bald head, earrings and loincloth carries a large cardboard box. Nearby is a little girl, her hair in pigtails, holding a balloon. There is a single Japanese samurai warrior in ornamented clothes and a small group of other supplicants.
I have spoken to my lord. He apologizes for the delay and bids you all welcome. He will greet you in his throne room. Enter and announce yourselves.
The gathering moves into the lobby of Dream's castle, led by the cohort from Asgard, Odin in front.
I am Odin Allfather of the Aesir. With me are my son Thor of the Aesir, and Loki Skywalker, the child of giants, but Aesir by right of blood brotherhood. We seek the key to hell.
The Egyptian gods follow. The jackal-headed Anubis, the cat goddess Bast, and Bes, a dwarf with a large bearded face and a tail.
I am Anubis, Lord of the Dead of the Nile Delta. With me are Bast, Lady of Cats, and Bez, a household deity. We seek the grant of the hell that was once Lucifer's.
The wide-eyed, richly dressed, black-bearded Japanese god moves forward. By his side hangs a sword.
To his shame, this one is Susanoo no Mikoto. His brave, swift, impetuous male augustness, son of Izanagi. His augustness, the male who invites. This one comes alone. There's a discussion that might be had at some point concerning territory.
Azazel floats forward, the whole of black emptiness filled with eyes and teeth.
I am Azazel, formerly a prince of hell. With me are the Merkin, mother of spiders, and Corinzon, once a duke of the Eighth Circle. We seek the return of our lands.
Corinzon is now wearing evening dress, with a rose in his buttonhole. From behind him, the huge genie, carrying the box in his heavily jeweled hands, steps forward.
I have the honor to be the personal genie of Lord Kilderkin, a manifestation of the Lords of Order, here incarnated for us in the form of this box. He too wishes to discuss the disposal of the realm that was once Lucifer's.
Aha!
Toddling up now is the small girl, no older than four, wearing clown makeup and a red nose. She's dressed in something like an oversized pillowcase with holes cut in it for her head and arms to poke out through. It drags on the floor. She's holding the string of her red balloon and looks small and vulnerable.
I is Shivering Jemmy of the Shallow Brigade, and I is a princess of chaos, and I is very important, and we want hell too. That's what.
I am the angel Remiel, set over those that rise. My companion is Duma, angel of silence. We are here to observe.
Morpheus appears at the door of his throne room in a formal robe, jet black, with stars twinkling in its lower part and huge sleeves. He holds the key to hell.
You are all welcome. Enter my throne room. I welcome you to the heart of the dreaming. I extend my hospitality to you all. Suites for you are being prepared, and your wishes regarding nourishment and recreation will be catered for, insofar as we are able to provide. You all, or almost all, seek the same thing. This key, and all it represents. The empty hell that once was Lucifer's. But you have all journeyed far to come here this day. You will be shown to your rooms. Tonight there will be a banquet for you and for any others who may arrive betimes. And tomorrow, we'll talk.
Dream's guests disperse. The throne room falls quiet. Dream has much to contemplate. This responsibility weighs heavily upon him. And its consequences are not confined to the dreaming. Elsewhere, with hell emptied and its gates sealed, the dead are coming back. The school is in the south of England, set around a quadrangle bordered by smooth green lawns. Its pupils have grown up to become politicians, journalists, scientists, and pillars of the community. Over nearly two centuries, a number of boys have gone on to lose their lives fighting for king and country in wars all over the world. It is now December 1990. The long wood-paneled corridors are silent. The pupils have gone home for the Michaelmas holidays. But the school isn't empty. The attic above the school's west wing is huge. Its sloping roofs meet high above the floor, some of which is boarded, some of which is bare, exposing the joists holding up the ceilings of the rooms below. There are cardboard boxes full of junk, piles of old sport bags, cricket bats, deflated leather soccer balls, a deer's head trophy, and dusty framed photographs of pupils from decades ago. 120 years of school history, which it neither wishes to throw away nor to have around. A lone and dusty bulb hangs from a crossbeam high overhead, but most of the light comes from the Gothic window at the gable end of the roof.
Roland?
Edwin Payne is pale and blonde with freckles. He wears a school blazer, school tie, short trousers, and high socks. On his head is a short, peaked British school cap. He is looking down anxiously at another boy.
Roland, are you awake yet?
Charles Roland lies on the floor, facing upward. His hair is dark. He's dressed in a sweater with jeans and sneakers. His cheek is bruised, his forehead sweaty. Although he is asleep and perhaps delirious, his eyes are wide open.
Mommy? No, it's me, Payne. Do you feel any better? So hot. Am I really here? I had this dream. I wasn't sure where it was. Payne?
Yes, I'm here.
Hold my hand?
All right.
I think it was a dream, but it seemed so real.
The Sandman, Act 2, Episode 5.
Season of Mists, Chapter 4, Interlude, in which the dead return and Charles Roland concludes his education.
So real. Like I was really there. Blood red worms were feeding on my arm. They didn't hurt much, but when they fell off, wriggled away, I found my arm was riddled with holes, like something that had been under the sea for a long time.
Gross!
And I ran out crying into the open, but it was snowing.
Charles's dream is so intense that he feels the cold again just by describing it. The cold of death. He feels the crunching under his feet.
Only it wasn't snow. It was the skeletons of birds falling from the sky. They crunched underfoot as I ran. And then I saw that they were trying to move, even the ones I'd crunched to bits.
Running blindly through the bizarre landscape of dream, Charles does not notice the tall figure in black. watching him grimly, its eyes like stars in pools of tar, its shock of ebony hair framing the chalk-white face.
The whole world was covered with dead birds, trying to fly.
Don't worry, old man. You'll be well again soon. It was just a dream.
I'm so hot. I want some water.
There's no water left, Roland.
Oh.
Roland looks up at Payne's pale face and blank eyes.
Your hand, it's so cold.
Well, that's not exactly surprising, is it?
No, sorry. I keep thinking I can hear people singing.
You can. It's Sunday morning, Roland. It's chapel service. They're singing hymns.
Chapel? But who have they got to pray to? That's sick. Sunday. You said it was Sunday.
Yes.
6 days then. That's all it's been?
That's right.
It seems like a lifetime.
Monday, 6 days ago. Charles Roland has just turned 13. In term time, the school dining hall would contain 300 or 400 boys sitting on benches to eat at the long trestle tables arranged along the length of its wooden floor. Now it is deserted. Huge portraits of long-dead headmasters in black robes and mortarboards alternate with tall arched windows along the walls. In the most distant corner, a single overhead light has been switched on, and at a table that can accommodate 20, three people are sitting. Charles Roland, the school's headmaster, and Miss Gribble, the school's matron, a thin woman in her late 40s.
I'm not sure this new chap has the gumption needed to deal with them.
Finish your suet pudding now, Roland.
Yes, matron.
You need building up.
Even when everyone's gone away, thinks Charles Roland, the school smells the same. The smell of school is a strange, pervasive thing. It's disinfectant, wood polish and ink, chalk dust, pipe tobacco, boiled cabbage, paper, flatulence and socks.
Mmm, delicious, yes?
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
Miss Gribble, the matron, is a thin woman, wearing a wool cardigan and a sensible skirt. No ornamentation, bar a nurse's watch pinned to her lapel. No makeup.
Oh, capital pudding, matron. Capital.
The headmaster is an angular-faced man, balding and bespectacled, in his 60s. His off-duty clothing is best described as shabby genteel. He is filling his pipe from an oilcloth tobacco pouch.
So, what do you have planned for this evening, then, eh, young Roland?
I don't know, sir. I've got to write a letter to my father, and then I'll probably just go up to the library and read. If the fog lifts, I'll go for a walk.
Good. Good. Keep yourself occupied. That's the important thing. Keep your mind off it. I'll be in my study. If there are any telephone calls for you, I'll come and find you.
Thank you, sir.
Even so, I must say this is most awkward. I appreciate the fact that your father is in Kuwait in this time of international upheaval, but are you quite sure you have no relatives to whom you could be sent for the rest of the school holidays?
Roland is staring, as if transfixed, at a portrait hanging high overhead of a previous headmaster of 90 years ago. A thin, skull-like face with psychotic eyes under a mortarboard cap.
Charles, the headmaster is talking to you.
There's no one that I know of, sir. Father was going to fly me out to Kuwait in the halls, I've always spent the holidays with him. Until now.
Don't be hard on the boy, Headmaster. Now, what I say is, it's all that Saddam Hussein's fault. Poor Mr. Roland didn't ask to be a hostage, did he? It's a good thing that we're both staying on at school over the holidays. Otherwise, I don't know where the lad could go.
You're right, of course, Miss Gribble.
Of course I am. And Roland can keep himself occupied, can't you, dear?
Yes, matron.
That's right. If you get bored, you come on up to the stand. I'll make you a cup of tea and we can have a bit of a natter.
Yes, matron.
Right. Now, you run along. Don't worry about the plates. Alfred will clean up later.
All right. Thank you, matron. Thank you, sir.
As he walks away down the long line of trestles, Charles Rowland feels the eyes of the Reverend A.N. Parkinson, M.A., headmaster 1901 to 1916, boring down upon the back of his head. Outside, it is cold. The damp autumn air hangs in a wet mist over St. Hilarion's School for Boys, over the world. Charles Rowland shivers as he crosses the courtyard. Founded in 1802, it was a boarding school for the sons of army officers, a huge Baroque building covered in ivy. Part of it looks like a church, or at least a chapel. Part of it looks more or less like a prison. The school now offers education to anyone who can afford it, particularly to those who live abroad but want their sons educated on British soil. Charles Rowland has been here for a year and a half, since his father left the country. His father is an architect, a tall, nervous man who designs hospitals. His mother is long dead. As he walks over to the empty library, Charles is composing a letter in his head to his father. It's the same letter he has wanted to write for a year and a half, and never has.
Please, Daddy, take me home.
As he enters the school library, the mist swirls about, forming shapes. If he had only turned back to look, he would have seen in it the outlines of boys, with blank faces staring expressionlessly from the fog, the dead watching the living with envy.
She looked through the tattered curtain, across at the handsome face of her husband, in whose lazy blue eyes.
Bookshelves filled with dusty old hardback books surround Charles Rowland, who sits on a high-backed chair reading an elderly copy of The Scarlet Pimpernel. On the other side of him is a window paned with leaded glass. It's now dark outside. If Charles glanced up, he would see ghostly faces pressed upon it, looking in on him as he sits in his little circle of light, reading. But he does not look up.
Roland! Charles!
Hello?
I know there isn't a lights out bell with everyone away, but still, it's a bit spot. It's time for you to get some sleep, young man.
All right, matron.
Even when it's empty, thinks Charles Rowland, you're never alone in a school. It belongs to all those dead people, all the other kids, the ones who sat at your desk or slept in your bed or ran down the corridors 100 years ago. They never go away. He enters the dormitory. The dormitory lights are out. It is a long room with a low ceiling. Iron frame beds are ranked along each side, their metal springs exposed, thin mattresses rolled up on top for the holiday. Only Charles's is made up, with threadbare sheets and a scratchy woolen blanket. Beside the bed is a little wooden locker. Charles is too busy putting on his pajamas to see the vague, faint outline of a boy upon each of the other beds, watching him climb into his. Even when you're alone, you're not alone. Back in the present, half an hour has passed. Roland still lies on the attic floor, Payne sitting next to him, his blank eyes and translucent face bearing a worried expression.
Payne, what was it like after you died?
Not very nice. I went to hell. I think it was hell. It was like a nightmare. The kind where you know it's a nightmare, but you still can't wake yourself up. It was just corridors. And I was hurrying down these corridors because I knew I was late for something. But I couldn't quite remember what. And then I realized that there was something behind me. Something horrible. But it was always one or two bends of the corridor behind. And even though it wasn't making any noise, I knew it was always there. And if I started to run, it would get me. So I just kept walking, as fast as I could, down these corridors, with something silently walking behind me. Something sad and lonely and terrible. Something that had all the time in the world. How long did this go on for?
What year are we in now?
1990.
About 75 years, I suppose. But it seemed far longer.
Payne?
Yes?
I'm not afraid of dying.
You should be.
Tuesday, 5 days ago. Charles Roland comes down to the dining hall for breakfast, but there is nobody there and no breakfast in sight.
Hello?
Puzzled and hungry, Roland goes to the boys' cloakroom lobby. It is lined with lockers above which old school photographs slowly fade, forgotten. Long dead boys' faces staring out blankly.
Maybe I ate them all.
In his locker, he finds his last packet of chocolate digestive biscuits. Then he walks outside to the war memorial, where he will eat the whole packet.
In memory of those boys from St. Hilarion's who laid down their lives in the Great War, 1914 to 1918. Andrews, RM, Alcock, GC, Barrow, LT, Beetle, J, Bleak, TL, Bruntsmith, KW, Cheeseman, NK, Cook, S.
The mists still hang low around the school. They have swallowed the playing fields and the pavilion and the art rooms. Roland is cold, and his hair and skin feel damp. He eats his biscuits on the circular wooden bench around the base of the war memorial. At lunchtime, when no one has appeared in the dining hall, he goes up to the headmaster's study.
Come!
Excuse me, sir. Oh, I thought you were alone. I didn't mean to disturb you.
In front of Roland is a large desk, behind which is seated the headmaster. Standing next to him is a severe-looking older woman wearing granny glasses. Her clothes look more in the style of the 1920s than anything recent. She rests a maternal hand on the headmaster's shoulder.
Theodore, who's your little friend?
Roland. Yes, Roland, this is my mother. Mother, this is Roland.
Hello?
How do you do, young man?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Dead. I died in January, 1942. Upon my death, I found myself in hell. This did not come entirely as a surprise to me.
Oh?
Theodore's father, who outlived me, had quite ruined my nerves and constitution by compelling me to submit to certain Hunnish practices in the marital bed. I suppose I could have asked for a divorce, but how would that have looked? I could not have stood up there and told a judge the revolting things that Theodore's father forced me to do. I banned him from my bedroom, and he slaked his unnatural lusts upon the housemaid.
Gosh.
As I said, I went to hell, where I was punished painfully and at length. Punished and punished. And punished. Theodore, what do you think you're doing? Smoking is a revolting habit. Give me that pipe.
Mother, I am headmaster.
You are nothing of the kind. Your mother's little boy.
She kisses the top of the headmaster's bald head.
That's right, Mother. Sorry, Mother.
People.
Charles finds himself wondering about insanity. But adults were strange, and he has few criteria by which to judge them. He heads for the sanatorium. Charles climbs the stairs to the san.
They're both so good and quiet, so well behaved.
Through the open door, he can see the matron wearing a white coat, her grey hair let down. She is holding something, but the door hides it from view.
Charles? Hello, dear. Come in. I've got some children to introduce you to. I haven't seen them for so long.
Matron?
Well, one of them I never really saw at all.
Oh.
Now, this is Veronica. She died a long time ago. She was a caught death, my little darling.
In the middle of the white, sparse sanatorium with its outdated medical equipment, the matron stands, holding two babies, one in each arm. The one on the left arm is in shadow. Charles cannot make out its features. The one on the right arm is a year-old baby with pale, translucent skin and staring blank eyes. Miss Gribble looks down on it. Adoringly.
A caught death. And we put her in the ground. But I knew she'd come back to her mummy. Her mummy and her baby brother.
Brother?
I think it's her brother.
The other baby in her arms is small, malformed and covered in blood, which has smeared itself on her lab coat. It has huge, white-pupilled eyes, no nose, a gaping mouth, and one hand that is a claw. It hardly has legs.
It never actually got born. I was only 16. I caught German measles and... Say hello to Charles, baby.
Hello, Charles.
No!
Charles? Don't you want to play with my babies?
Charles Roland returned to the dormitory. Hungry and scared. That evening, he stared out at the mist as night fell.
Leave me alone, Lydia. You've been dead 10 years.
You can't abandon me as the baby.
Charles watches as Alfred, the school groundsman, runs past, pursued by a woman and a child. The mist swallows the three of them. He will see none of them again. He sits up in bed that night, hungry and frightened. Nobody comes to turn off the lights. He lets them burn. Eventually, Charles Rowland falls asleep. 5 days later, in the attic, he drifts back from remembering to find Pain still sitting beside him.
Pain? Why are you up here? I mean, why did you hide in the attic?
Because my bones are up here. In that trunk, see? This is where I died. They hid it here. No one ever found it.
Oh.
Honestly, I don't think they could have looked very hard. All their stuff is still here. They hardly even covered their tracks. You can still see the circle they drew on the floor, over there.
The painted markings.
This was where they used to come, you see? At night, trying to raise devils that never came. They'd dress up and they'd do stuff. They'd kill frogs and rabbits and cats.
And you.
And me.
It is Wednesday, 4 days ago.
God, it's a bug! Yuck, a bug. Wake the bug up, Cheesy.
Yeah. Huh?
What's your pathetic name, bug? Twist his ear, Cheesy.
Ow!
God, what a subhuman moron. Come on, scum bug. What's your name?
Yeah. Ow, please! It's Charles Rowland.
That's better, bug. I'm Cheeseman. I'm Barrow. I'm Skinner. We're old boys. Very old. Twist his ear again.
The three older boys, teenagers, stand by Roland's bed. Cheeseman has a vicious grin. He's middling size with cropped red hair. Barrow is hefty with a twisted smile. Skinner is tall with sunken cheekbones and a cruel mouth. They all wear school uniforms, so it's hard to tell what era they lived in. And they are certainly no longer alive. All have the blank, white irised eyes of the dead.
Stop that!
Carving, chaps! It's Parkinson!
Ow!
You three, you silly boys!
Who is that?
Who's that? It's the headmaster, you germ!
It can't be the one in the painting! He's dead!
Shut up!
I know you three don't think I don't. Get away from that boy! Barrow, Cheeseman, and Skinner, isn't it?
Yes, Headmaster. Sorry, Headmaster.
I never trusted you three. You did something to that boy, didn't you? The one who disappeared.
Not us, sir. No, sir.
Liars. Still, it's all history now. Assembly in 10 minutes in the main hall. And you, live boy, clean yourself up.
Yes, sir.
We can wait, little bug. We can wait.
The school hall is large, with a stage at one end, upon which stands the dead headmaster, Mr. Parkinson. His audience is entirely composed of dead pupils, except one. Charles Rowland's pink face and dark eyes stand out in the middle of a row of pale-skinned, blank-eyed schoolboys aged between 9 and 17.
For those boys before or after my time, my name is Parkinson. I was headmaster here from 1901 until my death in 1916, and I am headmaster here today. We exist, as the Chinese would have it, in interesting times. However, despite any tribulations we might have experienced, we are all now back at school. At the old school, and I will not tolerate slackness or lack of discipline from any of you. Evil little boys. You all died here, or had no place else to which you could return. It seems that I am the only master who has resumed his duties at St. Hilarion's. Very well. Evil little boys. I am the only master. I will teach you what I learned. In hell, I learned so many things. You boy, the boy blubbing, front row, what's your name?
Mold, sir. Simon Mold, sir.
When were you here?
I died in 1953, sir.
I hung myself, sir. I'm sorry, sir. I didn't mean to, sir.
Of course you meant to, you silly little boy. Now stop blubbing or I'll give you something to blub about. I will spend today drawing up a timetable for the school. So this day will be devoted to silent study. I'll want to hear silence from all of you.
Sir?
What is it, boy?
What's the point? I mean, what are we going to study? Dead languages?
The point?
Ah, my eye!
You will mind your manners, boy. Who are you?
Peter Hinchcliffe, sir. I choked on my own vomit in 1977, sir. Booze and pills. Ah, sir, my eye is hanging out.
Get your hair cut, Hinchcliffe. You are schoolboys. You are at school. You come to school to study. Therefore, you will study. Mens sana in corpore mortua. Eh, boys? A healthy mind in a dead body.
Charles Rowland sits, hungry, in a classroom surrounded by dead boys, and tries to focus on his textbook. After a while, he becomes aware that no one else in the room is breathing. In the afternoon, the dead headmaster sent the boys down to the school lake to bathe. Charles felt his lips turning blue. His fingers and toes became numb. No one else seemed to notice the cold. He almost forgot how hungry he was. There is no food that night. After lights out, when the other boys are in their beds, Charles creeps out of the dormitory, driven by hunger. The school kitchen is huge, full of long work surfaces, big saucepans and gigantic ovens. There's no food to be seen. Charles enters the vast and empty darkness and searches the cupboards.
Oh, thank God! Bread!
Well, look who's sneaking out of the dorm after lights out, Cheesy. It's the new bug.
We said we could wait, new bug.
We don't like you, new bug. We think you're pathetic.
We're going to make you sorry you were ever born.
Three kids, one's not fair.
Fair? What's fair? Cheeseman was killed in the trenches after he was expelled. He was only 17. Barrow and I had already died of diphtheria. Was that fair? We were only kids.
We sacrificed a boy, all three of us, to the devil. We did stuff from old books. We did things you wouldn't believe.
But when we went to hell, they didn't care. They hadn't even known. They laughed at us.
That's not what I call fair. All the trouble we went through with a little brat, drinking his blood, hiding the corpse, stealing the host from the chapel. And nobody in hell gave a toss. We burned anyway. Just like you're going to, bug. Turn on the hot burrow.
Say, I'm just a pathetic, snotty little bug, not fit to lick the shit from your asses. Go on, say it!
Grab him!
Get the shirt off him!
Let me go, you bastards!
Get his arms out! We're going to spit roast you, bug!
When the headmaster catches you, you'll be in trouble!
Go on! Skewer him, Skinner! Do his nipple.
What's he going to do to us then, bug? Bay? Kill us? You scummy little kebab!
I smell bacon.
No, say it!
I'm
Oh, bloody hell, fellows, it's out cold already. We'd hardly started.
In our day, a good new bug would last for much longer than that.
Remember Somerville? Or Bartlett Jones? Boy Yates twins?
Oh, those were the good old days.
Happiest days of our lives.
Come on, old fellow. Come on. You've got to get up. Come on.
Please. Please. Don't hurt me. Not anymore.
It's all right.
Back up now. Nobody's going to hurt you. Honest. I know where we can hide.
Thursday. Charles Rowland spent the next day unconscious, bruised, burned, and bloody on the floor of this attic, one of the many to be found under the roofs of the old school. Friday. Charles Rowland was delirious. He talked to people who were not there, muttered snatches of gibberish and fragments of nursery rhymes. His rescuer, Edwin Payne, 1901 to 1914, tended him as best he could. Saturday, Rowland regained consciousness, although he was weak and in pain. The skin on his back was peeling and his sweater was matted with pus.
Let me take you to the San. Matron needs to look at your back.
No, I don't want to go.
And on Sunday, about half an hour after our story began.
Pain. Have they stopped singing?
Yes.
That's good. I thought that maybe it was me.
On Sunday, Charles Rowland died.
Hello, Charles.
Death is not what Charles expected. He sees an elfin face with an expression of mingled concern and greeting. The girl wears a bodysuit and leg warmers with high-top trainers. She is cute as hell, terminally perky, utterly alive, and making no effort at all to be this cool. Her Ankh pendant glitters in the cold light from the window. Charles gets up from the floor. His mortal remains stay where they were.
Is that me? Gosh, I look terrible.
Nah, your body doesn't look that bad. I've seen much worse.
I haven't.
Okay, Charles, enough sightseeing. We have to go now.
What about Payne?
It's you I'm here for, Charles, not him.
It's fine, Rowland. Don't worry about me. You go.
I took him already, Charles, and he's still dead. Now it's your turn.
No, if he's not going, then neither am I.
I don't have time to argue, Charles. There's too much going on right now. Look, you're coming with me, he stays.
He's my friend.
Take my hand, Charles.
I'm not going anywhere. Not without him. I'm sorry. I'm just not going.
Charles! Okay. Okay, fine. Stay. There really isn't time to argue about this, and I just don't have the energy. I've got too many other things to worry about. Stay if you have to. I'll catch up with you later.
Thank you. I really mean it. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I'll pick you up as soon as things are less crazy, Charles. You take care of yourselves.
So, what are we going to do now?
I'm not sure, but I can tell you what we're not going to do. We're not staying here any longer.
Huh?
Is this trapdoor the way out?
Leave the attic? But we can't. I mean, my bones are up here.
Well, so are mine. Not to mention my flesh and hair and stuff. But I don't see why that means I have to sit around up here until she comes back for us. Anyway, I don't feel ill anymore. I feel fine. Dead, but fine. Come on.
Rowland, I'm scared.
Look at it this way. Do you want to be a ghost in an attic all your life?
Yes, you're right. It's part of growing up, I suppose.
Come on! There are steps!
You always have to leave something behind you.
The two dead boys walk down the corridor that passes the headmaster's office.
What about all the rest of them? Do you think they'll ever have to go back to hell?
Go back? I don't know. I think hell is something you carry around with you, not somewhere you go.
Hmm.
Shh!
It's the headmaster. His door's open.
He can't hear us. He's not dead.
But his mother is. Oh, my God. He's got no clothes on in there.
Why then, Theodore? Mother's going to tell you some more of the horrid things your father did to her. After all, we don't want you growing up like your father, do we?
No, Mother.
Come on, let's go.
They pass the kitchen.
Cheeseman! Oh, you brute! Oh, stop it!
Sorry, Barrow, old man, but with none of the little tarts to fag for me and Skinner, it's going to have to be you. We have to have our little fun.
Language, Cheesy, language!
They're doing the same things they always did.
Cogito ergo sum, Descartes' maxim was unphilosophical in the extreme. Why? Because he assumes the existence of the thinker. Stop that, Connolly! He might as well have said that a rose is red and therefore it exists. Higher than himself can no man think. Tubber! As the learned Protagoras once said, Manson, put that away! Just because I'm not looking doesn't mean I can't see you.
The same thing. Again. They're doing it to themselves. That's hell.
I don't think I agree. I think maybe hell is a place. But you don't have to stay anywhere forever. So, where are we going now?
I don't know. Away from here. I'm sick of this place. There's a whole world out there. Hey, Payne, I bet we've got a while before they sort this mess out and she comes back to get us.
I'm game if you are. You can call me Edwin, you know, if you want to.
Oh, fair enough. I'm Charles.
Charles? What will your father think about you being dead?
He'll probably be relieved. I don't think he ever liked being a parent. And my mum won't mind. She's dead already, so she won't be prejudiced.
How long do you think we've got until she catches up with us again?
I don't know, but we might as well make the most of it. Just take it as it comes.
Death, you mean? Or life?
Either. Both. Anyway, I think we've learned all we're going to at school. Now, let's see what life's got to offer us.
The dreaming. It is evening. The castle of Morpheus of the Endless, Lord of Dreams. You will note that since we briefly digressed to follow events at St. Hilarion's School for Boys, the castle is no longer on a high hill. Now it is beside a lake, a huge fairy tale castle, light spilling out from its windows, reflected in the still waters. The location of the Dream Palace may change, but its main gate is always guarded by the same heraldic animals, the griffin on the left, the winged horse, a hippogriff, on the right, and the dragon-like wyvern stretched out on the lintel above. Two horses trot towards them, each with a rider on its back. The horses are noble thoroughbreds glittering with finery. The riders are dressed in silks. One is male, one is female.
Greetings to you, good gatekeepers. I pray you tell your master that Clurican of Faerie is here as a messenger and would have words with him.
Clurican wears a thin silver headband and fine clothes of silk. He has high cheekbones, discreetly pointed ears and eyebrows. His hair is long, tied at the back. He is unfazed as the huge head of the griffin moves to tower over him.
You are one
of many to arrive this day, Cloracan of Faerie. The Lord of Dreams is holding a feast for his visitors. If you and your companion advance, you will find yourselves in the banqueting hall. Leave the horses here. They will be stabled and groomed. Our Lord bids you enter.
I thank you, good gatekeeper. Nula, come.
The Sandman, Act 2, Episode 6.
Season of Mists, Chapter 5, in which a banquet is held, and of what comes after, concerning diplomacy and bedrooms, blackmail and threats, and an unusual recipe for sausages. Inside the gate, waiting in the vast marble lobby, Morpheus, dressed formally in a black robe, greets the latecomers. Behind him is the open doorway to his banqueting hall, from which the sound of discourse and debate can be heard.
Hello, Cloracan. Be you welcome in my house this night.
Thank you, Lord Shaper. I am sent here as an ambassador from the Court of Faerie. My sovereign lady and lord present their compliments. This lady is Nula, my sister.
Charmed, sire.
Cloracan's companion drops a polite curtsy. A head shorter than he is, her hair is the same shade of blonde. She is as beautiful as her brother is handsome.
You have ridden far. Do you wish to refresh yourselves before you join the meal?
We'll join you, sire, if it's all the same.
You are the guests here. Your wishes are paramount. Follow me.
The banqueting hall is well lit by hanging lamps, burning torches and candles. In the distance, floating about 20 feet in the air, the two angels, Remiel and Duma, wings folded, watch as the newcomers descend the great staircase behind Morpheus. At the center of the hall is a cluster of tables, one for each group of supplicants who are Dream's guests. The Egyptians and the Norse gods, the demons and Princess Jemmy of Chaos, one with the Lord of Order and his genie of the box, and a small flat table for Lord Susano, the Japanese thunder god. The places are set with flagons of wine, water and ale, platters of food for all tastes, and high-backed chairs at which many of the guests sit. Servants clad in nightclothes move dreamily between the tables. Bust, the cat-headed goddess of the Egyptians, is seated next to Thor and attempting to ignore him. But he is huge and muscular and already three-fourths drunk, his hammer within easy reach.
Do you know who the mightiest of the Aesir is, eh? I'll tell you. That's me. That's right. More ale over here, and step lively!
A servant, clad in pyjamas, for waiting upon Dream's table is part of tonight's dream for him, brings a pitcher of ale.
Here, Lord.
Good lad! Oh, lovely!
Bess, little Egyptian dwarf god, sits by Bust, eating a plate of rice cakes.
Just ignore the lout, blessed.
Bust has been served a huge stuffed mouse with an olive in its mouth.
You want to play with my hammer? Yeah, that's pussyhead. It's called Mjolnir. See if I rub it, it gets bigger. It's true.
I'm sure.
On the far side of Thor is Odin, and beside him, Loki. Odin is still wearing a long coat and a wide-brimmed hat. On his shoulder perch the grey and insubstantial shadows of two ravens. Odin has both hands wrapped around a huge goblet, his elbows rest on the table at each side of his wooden trencher, and he is brooding.
You're not eating, Loki Wolf's father. The Dream King's wines are good. You should wet your throat at least.
After 1,200 years, I'm out of the habit of eating, old father. And I fear that wine would go to my head. No, I'm content to watch.
To the right of Loki, sitting on a pile of cushions so that she can reach the table, is shivering Jemmy, the 4-year-old girl who is a princess of chaos. She has party food and cookies on her plate with a glass of lemonade. The servant in pajamas, a young man with rumpled hair, passes.
Can I have some more ice cream?
Certainly, Princess Jemmy.
I knowed you'd say that.
My lord, I was charged neither to eat nor sleep nor to wait before I gave the message from my king and queen. I understand that this may not be convenient, but
I would not have you risk the ire of Titania and Oberon, Cluricann. Speak your peace.
Lord Shaper, you now own the hell that was once Lucifer's. By ancient compact, Fairy must pay the tyend, our tithe, to hell every 7 years. We are forced to sacrifice to them 9 of our wisest, our most beautiful. Lord, all these beings are here to persuade you to grant them the rights to hell, but it would be to the benefit of Fairy if hell were to remain empty. We beg you, give it to none of them.
I see.
Of course, it's not just a favor we'd be asking. There is much that Fairy can offer you. For example, Nula here, my sister. She's for you. A gift to show our good faith.
My lord.
Nula's look conveys a willingness to accommodate whatever Morpheus might desire this night, and her beauty could soften the defenses of the strongest mortal. But the Lord of Dreams is not mortal, and his face remains expressionless.
There are many visitors here, Cluricann. They want many things. Tomorrow I will talk with you all and make my decision. Not now. Enjoy the banquet.
But my lord...
You have delivered your message. You have heard my response. Your obligation is fulfilled. The matter is ended, Cluricann. Your impertinence invites my severest displeasure.
I beg pardon, Lord Shaper. I did not mean to presume...
Enough, Cluricann. I will talk to you more later.
Come, sister. Let us find seats. Here. By this genie fellow. Your place is laid in clean plates and glasses.
Cluricann and Nula take their seats. Another servant approaches. A woman, this time. But also a dreamer, clad in her night attire.
My lord? My lady? What would you like me to bring you?
Just wine. Bring me a bottle and a glass. Forget the glass, but make that 2 bottles.
I will have flower blossoms, please. Violets, rose petals, and gilly flowers. And water.
As you wish.
Good day, O genie.
I am the servant of the box. I am not to speak, save that which my master bids me convey.
Who is your master, O servant?
Lord Kilderkin of Order.
And where is he?
In the box.
The oiled and polished genie gestures at the box itself, which sits on the table in front of him. It is unremarkable, made of plain cardboard. Further up the table, Loki watches, smiling.